Good evening and welcome. It's KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming. Tonight we'll have music and conversation from Jimmy Clanton. He's part of the lineup with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Volume 2. Details later in the program. First, though, imagine, if you will, the tater tot. Now imagine a recipe to turn this ordinary packing of potato into something extraordinary. And now, how about 50 recipes? Emmanuel Rogers has more.
Joining us today is Dan Whalen, author of Tots. 50 totally awesome recipes from tachos to sweet potato pie. Thank you for joining us today, Dan.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Oh, you're more than welcome. This is fun for me. Dan, we're talking about your new book, Tots. This is all about the different ways tater tots can be made into great meals. So I first want to ask you, how long have you been cooking, and what was the thing that drew you to making good meals?
I've been doing my blog for about 10 years. I've only been cooking for a few years longer than that, really. Growing up, my mom was an amazing Italian-American cook, so I pretty much stayed out of the kitchen when I was younger. What I do on my blog and what I do when I cook is I often take two different recipes or ideas and put them into one new thing, mostly focused on comfort food. So once the idea of tots came around and once the idea of this book came around, it was easy for me to come up with ideas where I was using tots as kind of the baseline for one of the dishes and then mashing them up with another new dish.
Wow, okay. So now the name of your blog is The Food in My Beard, Comfort Food and Mashups. Now, how long have you been doing the blog?
Blog's about 10 years old now.
Okay.
I was doing computer science stuff, and I had no intention of blogging for a living or even doing much blogging at all. You know, I just started it because I was trying to remember what recipes I was making myself.
Right.
And I was also sort of practicing computer science stuff.
I mean, so how does that come about? How do you go from computer science to, I'm going to teach you bachelors who know nothing about the kitchen how to make something that's edible?
I would say it was a very slow transition. When we started the blog, and I think a lot of blogs start this way, is it's more of like a let's learn together, let's cook together.
Right.
I was trying stuff out, and I was always honest, and I still am on my blog, that you know not everything is going to be a hit out of the park when I post it on my blog. The blog, for me, is more of a recipe sort of playground where I can try new things and not be afraid of making them have to be perfect. You know, when I write a book, on the other hand, that's when I take all my favorite recipes plus a bunch of new ones and test them a million times and make sure everything is worthy of being in a book and perfect recipe that can be followed by anyone.
Oh, wow. So you can actually be called America's Test Blog.
I think that name's taken.
Well, that's the kitchen, man. We're talking about the blog, but I'm going to leave it alone. Before we get any further, Dan, would you share with our audience where they can find your work, whether online or our YouTube or whatever? Where can they find you?
Sure. Mostly on the blog itself, which is The Food in My Beard, and also on social media at TFIMB, and that's the initials of The Food in My Beard.
Okay. All right. Thank you. So now, let's get back to this. How long have tater tots been around?
They were actually invented in the 50s, and it's a really cool story where Ore-Ida, the French fry company, was leaving a lot of potato scraps sort of on the cutting room floor when they made their French fries. One day, someone realized that they could kind of just bunch them all together and deep fry them. And they turned what was a lot of wasted food into a new revenue stream for their company, really.
Now, they have been around all this time. And you talk in your book about how many tots Americans eat each year. How many is that?
Well, last year we capped out at 3.5 billion with a B.
Right.
But I'm hoping that with the advent of this book, you know, we can get that number up a little higher if we all try harder.
Okay, well, you got 300 billion and 10 with me, so.
There you go.
I'm working on getting that higher, too. Now, why do you think tater tots are so popular?
I think it stems from a nostalgia thing. All the popular comfort foods right now on restaurant menus are things that were only on the kids' menu, you know, 15, 20 years ago. We were all eating burgers, mac and cheese,
right.
Now tater tots. And, you know, it's the stuff that you grew up loving. You know, once some chefs kind of take it and play with it and do cool things with it, it sort of allows it to be taken off the kids' menu and treated seriously, you know, as seriously as you can, but still, you know, keeping it fun.
Dan, what is it about tater tots that make them so versatile and useful for the mashups that you come up with?
Well, if you think about it, potatoes themselves are very versatile. And tater tots are potatoes, but they're small pieces of potato kind of clumped together. So So I use that as inspiration and place them in really where any potato or french fry would be in a dish. I try to insert tater tots. Not only that, I use them in place of bread or dough at times, you know, a pie crust. And I was really surprised with how much the tots would just work in almost any recipe I threw them at, really.
Right. Now, you know, this was curious to me because before I watched your blog and learned the full name, Comfort Food and All, I got into watching some other things that you were a part of other people's blogs, and you were doing different things. And I noticed something with your book and everything, that you do keep all of your things simple, and these are real comfort foods. Why does this simple yet great formula work so well for you?
I think that it's important when you want people to cook at home to keep things simple. You know, when I first started my blog, I was trying all these crazy recipes and going kind of like way above and beyond with making stuff homemade. And, you know, you get burnt out on that kind of stuff. And
right.
If you really want to realistically spend time in the kitchen, you need to figure out how to be efficient, but also be delicious. So I've learned ways to kind of not cut corners, but like come up with a more straightforward way of doing some things. I think because of my lack of professional training, being self-taught has helped me see things a different way, I guess.
Well, I guess that's a good thing because most professionals learn from people that actually started in their own kitchens and learned how to do things. So you're on track.
Right.
Yeah. So now, Dan, people can also make tater tots at home. Is this a hard thing for them to do?
I think the homemade tater tot recipe in here is mainly geared towards the real tater tot aficionado. You know, it's probably one of the harder recipes in the book. I still would place it medium level in terms of difficulty of overall cooking. It's a little more involved than a lot of the other stuff in here. But I still think people should try it. They come out really crispy. They come out nice and soft on the inside, and they're awesome. They're definitely better than the store-bought ones if you get it perfectly right.
Right.
But the other great thing about making them yourself is you can mix your own sort of stuff right in there. You can add little pieces of bacon or onions or different flavorings right into the middle of the tots. Or you could do it with vegetables, like you could do zucchini tots or cauliflower tots or beet tots.
Right.
You know, you could make something that you actually can't buy at the store, and then it's even all that much more worth doing it.
Oh, wow. Yeah, this is distracting because it's simply making me hungry out here.
Yeah.
Now, before I talk to you a little bit about some of those recipes, I'd like to know, is there anything that you have found that doesn't go well with tots, that just didn't work out?
Well, I mean, I was able to work them into desserts pretty seamlessly, so...
Oh.
For the most part, I was having success. The only trouble I had was there was definitely one major failure that didn't make it into the book. It was a meatloaf that I was trying to make a crust out of tater tots to surround the meatloaf. And while it still tasted really good, I couldn't get it to structurally hold up. You know, it would always fall apart in the end.
I can see where that would be great.
Oh, I know. It tasted really good every time, but it would end up not being worth it if it all just would fall apart. So it kind of defeated the point of cooking it and serving it that way.
Okay. Something caught my eye on page 67 that it's like, God, I need to go try this now. The cheeseburger tot sliders is just one doggone good use of tots. Where did this idea come from, man?
Well, as I was saying, I just, you know, I tried to just think of places where I could replace either bread or potatoes with the tots. And, you know, burgers make so much sense because usually when you eat a burger, you're having fries too.
Right.
These work best with the round coin-shaped tots that are actually called Crispy Crown.
Ah.
They're the perfect size to hold the burger patty, and they make these tiny little burgers that are just really cutesy, really like they could also be elegant in a way, and they're just like one huge bite. You eat the whole thing in one big bite. It's a really fun recipe, and actually I just did a video for them that's on my Facebook page now that's doing really well, so you should definitely check it out.
Okay, well, I'm hungry enough. And looking at things like this now, a tot shakshuka, what is that?
Mm-hmm. Shakshuka is a Middle Eastern dish, and it's gaining popularity around here a lot in the past 5 years or so. And what it is eggs that are baked in a spiced, sort of like rich tomato sauce. So it's a popular brunch dish because brunch is so popular now. And what I did was just, I really just made a simple shakshuka dish and put a few tater tots on top, you know?
Right.
And it came out really good.
Now, I have to ask you, because our time is getting short, what is your favorite recipe in the book?
In terms of the amount that I've eaten, my favorite is the breakfast burrito. I always had tater tots on hand, and you know, I'd put them in a pan with some eggs in the morning, and I loved it so much that I actually wrote it into the book. And putting a few tater tots in your burrito is just such a good flavor and texture to have in there.
Right.
But I also really love the cookies, and a lot of people would be surprised that there's a lot of desserts in here, but
yeah.
The cookies are just so good. They, you know, they have sweet and salty and crunchy pieces of potato, and they're great.
Yeah, I saw the eclairs, and it was like, oh, wow, this is just too much for me. But, Dan, do you have anything in the works that you would like to share with our audience?
Well, I do have another book coming out in the fall, and that one's called Comfort Food Mashups. You know, keep an eye out for that, but also just go to my website, thefoodinmybeard.com, and check me out at TFIMB on social media.
With Dan, I'm so sorry. Our time is up. I would love to speak to you more about this, and maybe I'll contact you about that.
For sure.
But thank you for joining us today, and I really enjoyed this book, Tots, 50 Totally Awesome Recipes from Tachos to Sweet Potato Pie. I think you did that on purpose for people for me to read.
Yep.
All right. Well, you have a great day, and hopefully I'll talk to you after the book tour. You too. That was Tot-tastic.
Bye.
Bye-bye.
That was Emmanuel Rogers in conversation with Dan Whalen, again the author of Tots, 50 Totally Awesome Recipes from Tachos to Sweet Potato Pie. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Up next, Jimmy Clanton. Jimmy charted multiple times from the late 50s into the early 60s, and like many of the teen idols of the day, he found himself in a couple of movies as well, with a rather unfortunate and hilarious mishap in one of them. First, though, I was curious about his nickname, or billing, if you will, and asked where the title of the Swamp Pop R&B Teenage Idol came from.
You know, I'm not really sure. I think the teen idol thing came from a combination of Dick Clark and Alan Freed. Between the two of them, I think that's how the teen idol came about. The Swamp Pop thing kind of came about little by little over a few years. Reason being is that down in Louisiana, the truth of the matter is Swamp Pop is a combination of rock and roll and rhythm and blues. Swamp Pop always has horns, and all of my early records and the band that I was with, we all had a horn section as well as full rhythm. That was why it was called Swamp Pop. It was rock and roll with rhythm and blues, because rhythm and blues always seem to have horns. I never considered myself a part of the New York, Jersey, Philadelphia doo-wop sound. My roots stayed with that Swamp Pop sound. So was I different? I guess I was, but that's where the Swamp Pop came about. She'll be at your door. It takes a long, long time to stop that dream from burning. If you ever see her, you're gonna start that yearning. She really done you wrong, and now she's gone, gone, gone. Just a dream, just a dream.
Just a dream.
All our plans and all our schemes.
All our schemes.
How could I think you'd be mine?
You'd be mine.
The lies I tell myself each time. I know that we could never last.
Never last.
Well, this may be a chicken or the egg kind of thing. Was Just a Dream, was that the song that landed you on Dick Clark's American Bandstand, or was it you performing that song on American Bandstand that caused it to blow up?
Well, I want to be humble about this.
Okay. Good for you. Appreciate it.
It was a combination of the song and my Louisiana twang. And then once I made the first national exposure, the girls really, really got close to me because I was told that I was a real good-looking kid. And on top of that, you could sing. So, you know, that combination really is what accelerated a career overnight, beginning with me singing Just a Dream on Dick Clark's show, 1958, American Bandstand. Within a matter of 10 days, I was just bombarded with invites to do shows, national exposure with a major booking agency. It was literally overnight because of that initial Dick Clark American Bandstand 1958 show that I did.
Wow. At this point, I guess you finally quit your day job.
Well, actually, it's kind of funny because I didn't have a day job. I was in Baton Rouge. I was going to LSU. I was going to college.
Oh.
And so my whole plan was I'm going to be a geologist, find out where oil is, and I'll do the geology Monday through Friday. And then I love to play the guitar, and so I'm going to do the gigs on weekends. And I'm going to do that till I fall over. But then one day I had a good, quick, basic algebra thinking. And one day I sat down and I said, wait a minute. Our band is so popular, and I am popular, and I'm making $40 to $45 a night. Now, this is 1957.
Sure.
So, you know, $45 in 1957, what would that be today, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So I said, now, well, let's see. If I go just 4 years to college or, you know, and then, of course, get my master's, 5 years in school, and I'm doing $40 to $45 a night, 4 to 5 nights a week. Whatever job I get in geology, could I make up that 5 years that would cost me those engagements? So I thought for about 5 minutes and decided, you know what, the music is really coming up.
Oh, why do I love you? How can I live in misery? I know that I won't forget you. Now I know it's too late for me.
But I've got to tell you, this to me, this is so interesting. I never wanted to do the singing. I only wanted to be a guitar player.
Nice.
And so I was playing with this one little band right around the time I was a senior in high school.
Mm-hmm.
And I overheard the band leader say to this other guy in the band, he said, well, I have to pay him $5 a night more because he sings. I went, whoa. And I had sung, but it was, you know, really in a Baptist church just from a hymn book.
Oh, sure. Right.
I never thought about singing, so I forgot about that. And then about a year later, I start working with this group called The Rockets. I was just making what we call scale as a guitar player.
Sure, yes.
And I noticed that he was always doing all the singing. So I thought about it. I said, you know what, that band leader, he gave that one guy $5 a night more for singing. Again, $5 in 1957, you know what that would buy, you know what I mean? I mean, still in those days, you know, a Coke was a nickel, a hot dog was 10 cents, you could go to the movies for 20 cents, and so forth. So I went to Dick Holler, and I said, Dick, I said, you know, you're doing all the singing all night, and man, that must be tiring on you. I said, now look, I said, I'd be willing to do a song here or there. I said, however, the band I used to be with, the guy that sang, got $5 a night additional. And he looked at me and he said, well, let's just try it out. I said, okay. So never knowing what was going to happen, I went up to the mic, and as we're doing this song, everybody pretty much stopped dancing, and everybody just gravitated right down to the front of the stage, the guys as well as all the girls. And they were all just looking up and staring at me, and I'll never forget as long as I live. This one guy, because, you know, you would think that the guys didn't want the girls staring at Jimmy.
Yeah.
But this one guy looked up the other guy while I was singing, and I read his lips. He said, wow, he said, that guy can sing.
Wow.
Yeah, and so that did it. And I started singing, and truthfully, in no time at all, I was really the main attraction for the band. And that's how I ended up. Boy, I could go on and on and on. How Just a Dream came about is really a Happy Days script.
So is this why, then, it went from the Rockets to Just a Dream was released as Jimmy Clanton and his Rockets?
Correct. Well, what had happened is that the Rockets, we were sitting around one day. Dick Holler was about 2 or 3 years older than me. So this girl comes over. She dated Dick, and she said, out of the clear blue, another guy was telling me there's a recording studio in New Orleans. Now, New Orleans was only 90 miles from Baton Rouge.
Okay.
And that's where Fats Domino was from, and Little Richard would came there, and Lloyd Price, all these early swamp pop artists. And she said, he told me that at that recording studio, for $25, they will give you a whole hour of recording time. Yeah, and Dick said, oh. So we go to New Orleans. Now, let me also say this. My friends cannot believe it. Never, ever, ever at that time was there ever even a passing thought of me ever, so to speak, doing anything in music. It never, ever, ever crossed my mind. You know, I'm going to be a geologist, I'll do gigs on the weekend, and live happily ever after.
That's Music in Conversation with Jimmy Clanton in San Bernardino, soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll, Volume 2, along with the Dukes of Doo-Wop, Kathy Young, Charles Weldon, Gene Chandler, Larry Chance and the Earls, Norman Fox and the Rob Roys, and from the Platters, Sonny Turner. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming.
I trusted you for such a long time.
Go to New Orleans, but it was strictly Dick who fronted the band with the singing. I still was just a guitar player. So we record all these songs that he had written, and so he said, okay, that's it. I told you, this is like a script from Happy Days. So the engineer stops. He said, well, look, he says, you got 5 or 6 more minutes here that you paid for. You don't have anything else? And Dick said, no. And all of a sudden, he looked over at me. He said, Jimmy, do you have anything? I say, well, I just happen to have something. Now, I don't remember before that writing the song. How in God's name did I remember all the words to it? No cassette recorder, nothing. And yet, I said, well, I got this little song I wrote because I didn't tell him, but it was about my first love and breaking up. And so it was a song called I Trusted You. It was that true swamp pop, easy ballad, girl meets guy, they fall in love, they break up. I mean, it was just a typical Louisiana swamp pop love song, okay?
Sure, okay.
That's what I call it. We recorded it, and that was it. We go back to Baton Rouge. One day, about 10 days later, I get a phone call. This guy gets on the phone. He said, Jimmy, he said, my name is Johnny Benson. He said, I'm from Jackson, Mississippi. And he said, I own a record company called Ace Records. Well, that just piqued me because I knew Ace Records, and he had this big hit on Ace Records called Rockin' Pneumonia, the Boogie Woogie Blues,
yes,
with Huey, Piano Smith, and the Clowns.
Love that tune.
And I go back to New Orleans, meet up with him. I had a real tinny sound, I'll admit that back in then. But it was good enough to be attractive, that's for sure.
Sure, yeah.
And he said, I would like to take you in that song. He said, I'd like to make a record with you and sign you to a contract. Now, this is all overnight. You know, I'd never been out of the Gulf Coast, and this is rocking my world. I mean, my world is rocked.
Yeah.
Well, I mean, I said, well, I'm still with the Rockets. He said, well, I don't want Jimmy Clanton, the Rockets. He said, I want Jimmy Clanton. I said, well, I still want to play with the band. Oh, that's no problem. We recorded with the New Orleans band that backed up everybody, the real pros. And we put out on a local area, I Trusted You. And it was out for about 3 or 4 months and got a lot of airplay in Baton Rouge. I was the first artist locally to ever have a record that be played on the radio. In fact, to be honest with you, my arranger producer down in Houma, he did some homework on something. He said, Jimmy, he said, I'm going to tell you something. He said, I've done my research. He said, I can tell you right now, you are the first of Swamp Pop white kids to ever record.
Mm.
He said, you are the first. And I never thought about that. But I believe it when I thought about who had recorded before me, a white kid with that sound. Nobody.
Right.
Yeah. And so anyway, so we put it out, and, you know, we get a lot of gigs from it. And so I get a call from him about March. This is 1958. And he said, you know what, it's time for us to do another session. And and he said to me, he said, you got any more songs you wrote? What? Well, I don't remember, to be honest with you, if I just put pen in hand. But all of a sudden, man, songs are coming left and right from my ballpoint pen. And I said, okay, I got this little song. And I go through this song, it's what we call a four-chord change, and I'll never forget this as long as I live. That senior horn player for all of the songs that went forth from that Swamp Pop sound down there, he looked over and he said, that is a hit. It turned out to be just a dream. And one day, Johnny Vincent calls me. It's April of 1958. And he said, I want you to pack a suitcase. He said, I am sending you to Philadelphia. I've got it all set up. You're going to be on this new show called American Bandstand. So I go, ladies and gentlemen, with a new song. And it's really become very popular. Would you welcome Jimmy Clanton? Well, I step out there, and I'm telling you, I thought there was something wrong with how I was dressed because all of the girls just stared holes through me. Well, that's what happened. And so the next thing you know, Johnny Vincent got orders for over 100,000 copies of that record the very next day.
Oh, my gosh.
The next day. Within 2 weeks, I am flying to New York. I'm signing with a major booking agency. And the next thing I know, Alan Freed had already asked for me. I'm doing all of Alan Freed shows. I was the lead in his iconic rock and roll movie, Go Johnny Go. All of the Dick Clark things. And that never, ever stopped until the English invasion. I was in the Army. I came out, and lo and behold, I come out, and what greets me but a song called Venus in Blue Jeans.
Yes, indeed.
And bam, I'm back again. And now, 60 years later, I have a fan following that is phenomenal. All of my songs are as popular now. Even the B-side of all my records are popular with all my fans. And when I do a show here and there, they're there by the thousands, and it's just phenomenal.
Absolutely. Well, you mentioned you were one of the few white singers to come out of the New Orleans R&B rock and roll sound. Were you played equally on the black radio stations of the time, or any challenge getting you on the air with that kind of?
That's interesting, because I was told, I never followed all of this, but I was told in 1958 that Billboard, which had, you know, charted records, you had the pop list. I was told that at one particular point there, that Just a Dream was number one in the R&B market.
Yes, yes, indeed. That's Music in Conversation with Jimmy Clanton in San Bernardino, soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll, Volume 2, along with the Dukes of Doo-Wop, Kathy Young, Charles Weldon, Gene Chandler, Larry Chance and the Earls, Norman Fox and the Rob Roys, and from the Platters, Sonny Turner. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVCR. It's on 91.9 KVCR. Online at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. Just ahead, being taken under the wing by the original Drifter, Clyde McFadder, also his times on the movie sets, with a story about a long piece of plywood, a brick, and a window. I don't think this question is too far out of line, because we've heard this about other people. Any instances that you can recall about getting to a gig and only then folks finding out that you're white?
You know, that's very interesting. That's a very good question. I've got a heck of a reply for that. Again, remember, there was no such thing invented called the photocopy machine, email. So everything was by regular U.S. mail. Just think about that.
Yep.
You know?
Yep.
I've got this gig, and I'm going to Philadelphia, and I'm going to be one of the artists at the Uptown Theater. Now, let's face facts. We're talking about 1958. My high school was all white kids. My neighborhood was white kids. I get to Philadelphia, and they book me into a hotel, and I don't see another white person there but me. And I'll be honest with you, I got scared to death.
Oh.
Because I didn't realize what was happening to me emotionally, but it was like I'm in a foreign land. I mean, just think, Lord, I just turned 19, you know? I've never been out of Louisiana in my life, never been on an airplane. I mean, I'm a fish out of water. And then, my God, I get to the Uptown Theater. It's in a black neighborhood. All the musicians are black. And then I find out the audience is all black.
Of course.
Now, Joanne Campbell was a white girl. She was on the show. Yeah. I was the only white boy. And this guy comes over to me, puts his hands on my shoulder, takes me under his wing that whole week, and just became such a mentor to me. Clyde McFadder.
No.
Clyde McFadder became my mentor. And back in that day, there were speakeasies. And I'll never forget, after we finished all that show and we're walking down this dark street of Philadelphia. I got stories, brother. And so we're walking down this dark alley, and the next thing I know, I'm going, "Whoa, my God, where are we, Clyde?" He said, "Well, just wait a minute. Now, this is something out of one of those Dracula movies, you know, the dark streets of the UK. And you're walking down, and there's mist in the air. And he knocks on this door, and a little peephole opens. And this black guy says, "Clyde." Oh, yeah. I'm telling you a fact, man. And so the door opens, and you go inside, and that's the biggest party going on you ever saw in your life. Everybody's drinking, and everybody's dancing, bands going on, and the black guy looks at Clyde, and then he looks at me. And Clyde says, "He's with me." And the guy said, "No problem."
Wow.
So that was how the ice was broken with me and other black artists. I never had a problem from that day on.
Nice.
And they never had a problem with me.
That's beautiful. And Clyde McFadder.
You are probably only one. I say this very matter-of-factly. I don't think in my 50 years now that I've told that story to an interviewer, other than maybe one other time. You're the second one maybe in 50 years.
Mm. Wow.
I'm in one of those movies today,
excellent.
Brother.
I'm having a great time. I am having just a great time with this, and I appreciate your time.
I told her when it comes to talking, I'm the sweetest, sweet talker in the world. Well, she said, "You better start talking if you want me to be your girl." And she said,
"Go, Jimmy, go.
We saw in 1959, Go Jimmy Go. This was another top 40 hit. And so there was a movie of the same title. Which one was first? Was this song written for the movie, or was this song?
What had happened was, okay, I had recorded Go Jimmy Go.
Okay.
Okay. And then Alan Freed comes over to me backstage at one of his big shows.
Uh-huh.
And just very nonchalantly, he says, "I'm getting ready to go to Hollywood." He said, "I'm getting ready to produce." I don't remember if he said my last. Come to find out, it was. He said, "My last rock and roll movie." And he told me a little about the storyline. And he said, "It's about this kid, Johnny Melody." And he said, "I'd like for you to play the lead because you'd be perfect for it." Now, here's another one for the archives.
Okay.
The actual movie was titled, and I even sent my original script, is now in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame in Cleveland, by the way.
Cool.
My original script for this. And the original script on the front says Johnny Melody, because that was to be the title. Well, what happened was is that Chuck Berry simultaneously comes out with this huge hit called Johnny Be Good.
Yeah.
And, of course, the hook of that song was Go, Johnny, Go. Go, 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 Johnny, go. I used to sing it all the time on shows. So Alan Freed, being the exploiter that he was, he said, "I'm going to change the title of this movie, and it's going to be called Go, Johnny, Go," because he grabbed onto the Go, Johnny, Go, and in the movie, as the movie starts to play, Chuck Berry is singing that big, big hit, Johnny Be Good. Go, go, Johnny, go. So he changed the movie title from Johnny Melody to Go, Johnny, Go.
Well, I talked to her off the floor when she said,
go, Jimmy, go. Go, Jimmy, go.
The song was Go, Jimmy, Go, but the movie ended up being called Go, Johnny, Go.
Now, I got a cute one for Go, Jimmy, Go. I'll tell
okay.
you. Doc Pomus and Morty Schumann were very, very successful songwriters in New York. They wrote Save the Last Dance for Me, for the Drifters.
Yeah.
They wrote This Magic Moment, one of the classics.
Yes.
They wrote for Elvis. So they kept pumping me for songs. Well, I would listen to him because he was famous, you know, by that time, had so many hits. So he kept throwing songs at me. And so I don't forget how it came about. But I kind of liked that Go, Jimmy, Go. We're going to do the horns in the background, like my sound from the Swamp Pop. So we finished doing Go, Jimmy, Go with the background voices and everything. And as I'm walking out of the studio, I see the background voices, the girls, and the one girl from the group walks over and very, very bothersome look on her face. She says to me, Jimmy, are you sure you never recorded this as Go, Bobby, Go? I looked at her, I thought, are you crazy? I said, no. You know, I said, my name is Jimmy Clanton. You know, Go, Jimmy, Go. And I walked out like, you know, what's with her? Well, within a few months, backstage, and I'm doing a big multiple act show, and Bobby Rydell walks over to me. He said, you son of a gun, you stole my song.
What?
I said, what? He said, yeah. He said, I recorded Go, Bobby, Go, and they decided not to put it out. Next thing I know, Doc Pomus gives a song to you. You put it out as Go, Jimmy, Go, and it's a big hit. I said, yeah. I said, eat your heart out, baby. And then I eventually got a hold of Doc Pomus. I said, you son of a gun. I said, I'm going to break your neck. I said, but I better not, because it became a top 10 hit for me, so I can't be too mad at you, no.
That's Music in Conversation with Jimmy Clanton in San Bernardino, soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll, Volume 2, along with the Dukes of Doo-Wop, Kathy Young, Charles Weldon, Gene Chandler, Larry Chance and the Earls, Norman Fox and the Rob Roys, and from the Platters, Sonny Turner. More at affordablemusicproductions.com. You're listening to KVC Arts on 91.9 KVCR, also at kvcrnews.org. I'm David Fleming. You said that you had a story to sort of wrap this up.
Yeah, I've told this a couple of times in 50 years. I'm going to crack up myself when I think about it. Okay. Now, there is a scene in Go, Johnny, Go.
Okay.
And the scene shows me, it's a long, long scene, and it shows this long avenue. And on this avenue, it shows me walking along, and you see different shops, okay, one after another, multiple shops. And it shows me coming up and stopping in front of this jewelry store.
Okay, cool.
And I don't have the money for an engagement ring. And I am so down because nothing's panned out with getting my song heard on the talent show with Alan Freed. I haven't heard back on that. And, you know, nothing's working out. Don't even have enough money to get my girl an engagement ring. And the spur of the moment thing is I reach for a brick, and it was a real brick. I reach for the brick, I pick it up, and I go right there to the big show glass of the jewelry store, and I just crash in a piece on the edge there so I can reach in to steal this ring.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the scene is, okay?
Okay.
Now, as we're getting ready to shoot this scene, I come from back because this whole street scene is all one huge one, not multiple pieces. One huge piece of plywood. All those storefronts are painted on the plywood. It's a long, long piece of plywood.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I come from the back of that, and I'm coming around because it's a scene where they have to wet the street. You know, there's a mist, and it's slightly rainy. And as I came around where Alan was sitting, I'm getting ready to do this, and out of the corner of my eye, I see this whole one piece. It's being held up by just a couple little 2x4s that are propped. I thought,
uh-huh.
Oh, is that how they do this? You know. So we get around. Okay, we're going to do a run-through. Okay? So I'm walking along the street, and I go and I pick up the brick. And as I walk to the jewelry store window, the back of my mind says, you know what? This thing is held up with one piece of plywood. If you really hit this window with that heavy, heavy break, this whole thing could come over. I thought that, you know, real quickly. So in a run-through, I just kind of namby-pamby just touched the window with the brick because I didn't want. And immediately Alan Freed is over the corner. He said, stop, cut, cut. He said, what are you doing? He said, you don't do this in a namby-pamby, man. You're frustrated. You got to hit that window with the brick. I said, but Alan, I said, this thing is only held up with 1 2x4. Oh, no, blah, 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 blah. Now you hit that window like you're a man. Like you're a man. Are you sure? He said, yes. Okay. So here we go. Action. Action. So I go over, pick up the brick. I say my lines. I go to the jewelry store window, and I just crash. Man, I hit that. And honest to God, this is exactly what happened. All of a sudden, it was like a 9,500-foot redwood tree. You heard it. And the whole thing came crashing down when I hit that with the brick. The whole set, I'm talking about, that thing was 50 feet long. It just all collapsed right there in a huge loud sound. Oh, my God, what have you done? I said, I told you I couldn't hit that thing heavy. And so that's exactly what happened. I knocked the whole damn thing totally over. It just crashed. So it took him at least an hour to get it back and pop it back up. And so they said, okay, we've got extra planking back there. But, yeah, I knocked the whole thing down.
I have to track down the movie just for that scene.
You do. I promise you. You need to see the movie just for that. Yeah.
Oh, well, go, Jimmy, go indeed. Oh, my gosh. Well, Jimmy, you had the power behind it, so yeah. Oh, my goodness.
You know, I've been blessed. This September, I will be 80 years old, and I don't understand it, but the good Lord has blessed me. In fact, on my Facebook, I'm saying goodbye. I'm going to go retire. And I've got 4 shows over the next year, and I'm saying goodbye to everybody at that show because that will be the last time they see me on this side of the grave. That's it. That's been hard. I just did it up in Pottstown, PA, said goodbye to everybody, thanked them. It's been a fantastic run. I'm going to do the same thing out there in California, and I've got one in San Antonio. I've got a couple more, and I'm saying goodbye to everybody, and here's how I look at it. I sang in Pottstown, almost 80 years of age. My voice was as good, if not better, than ever in my career. I'm not exaggerating. It's a long story one of these days. I'll tell you, there's a verse in the Bible in Romans chapter 8, and it says here, it said, for God causes all things to work together for good to them that love God, to them that are called according to his purpose. I had almost major problems with my voice back in the early 60s, to the point where I went to the hospital. They said, if you don't learn to use your voice correctly, you're going to have an operation, and you're going to really be out of the works. And it scared me to death. And they handed me a card. They said, this man can work with people as a voice coach. I went to this man to help me. And I went on voice silence. The hospital said, you can't talk. I mean, it was unbelievable. I could not sing. Wow. I talked as if I had, you know, just like a robot. And so I went to this man, and in 1 year, this man, with the way he coached me, I went from what we call middle C to hitting B-flat under high C perfectly. No. And as I began to practice and learn how to do what he taught me, do you know I cannot sing incorrectly? I wouldn't even know anymore. I sing, I talk correctly, and my voice reflects the correct way of singing without changing my style. And people have marveled. I said, you know what? Getting sick ended up being the best thing that could have happened to me vocally. Because my voice, within a year after that, and each year has progressed to where it's become fuller, as we call it, fatter, because I've taken care of myself and know how to sing correctly. And so, yeah. I'm going to go out at the top of my game, sir. I don't want to go out as some of the people I've heard. I won't put names out there, but it's almost embarrassing. I don't know if they go on stage still because they need the money or they just live for the accolades on stage. I'm not sure. But all I know is some of them, as I say, I wouldn't name names. It's embarrassing. I couldn't do it. I wouldn't do it. So I'm going out. At the top of my game, you understand?
You still got your voice. You still have your hair.
Yes, I do. Yes, I do. Yes, I do, very much so.
Wow. So your show, August 18th in San Bernardino, this will be one of four farewell concerts. This is going to be a major treat, very important for a lot of people. This is incredible, Jimmy.
Well, it's a strange feeling. I probably will tear up. It's a strange feeling because it seems like just yesterday, you know, I was 18, I was doing Just a Dream and Venus and Blue Jeans all over the world.
Yeah.
And now I read something by somebody, and, you know, I can attest to it. I don't know how old you are, and you don't have to tell me. They said, I was born, I blinked, and it was over.
Wow.
You know, for me, I can understand that. I was born, I blinked, and now I'm going to be 80 years of age, and I've got shows. I'll be 81 for that last show.
Mm.
And I'm thinking, my God, man, I was born, I blinked, now it's over. And I want to go out at the top of my game, like I say. I felt this coming on, and so I'm really happy that when they come to see me, they're going to hear Jimmy at his very, very best vocally. He still looks good. He still got his hair. And that's how I want to be remembered. You know what I mean?
Nice, nice. That's beautiful, actually.
Thank you.
I see you in the moonlight. I see you in the trees. Oh, how is it possible to love just a dream? So angel, my angel, I'll close for today and write you tomorrow. So hear what I say.
I've been speaking with Jimmy Clanton in San Bernardino soon with Legends of Doo-Wop and Rock and Roll Volume 2, along with the Dukes of Doo-Wop, Kathy Young, Gene Chandler, Charles Weldon, Larry Chance and the Earls, Norman Fox and the Rob Roys, and from the Platters, Sonny Turner. Tickets and information at affordablemusicproductions.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Jimmy Clanton. Thanks also to Nathan Gothels of Affordable Music Productions. Here at KVCR, thanks to Lillian Vasquez, Rick Dulock, Jessica Greenwell, Sharina Wad, Isel Quapio, Benjamin Perper, and KVCR General Manager Keith Birkfeld. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. You can hear past KVCR's programs at kvcrnews.org/arts. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support, which you can do any time of the year. Go to kvcrnews.org. And thanks again.